I know everything's moving. Whatever the order is.
Whatever this line.
I think he opens it and then he says, yeah. So yes, open, then acknowledge. Okay, I have 3:30, so we are ready to begin. Hello, I'm Chelsea Specht, Associate Dean of Faculty, and I am acting speaker for the Senate meeting today as our speaker, Jonathan Oshorn, is unfortunately out sick. A reminder to everyone, whether you're in person or online, please do sign in. And welcome to the Cornell Sun and their journalists present in our audience today. This meeting is officially called to order. Love doing that. We begin our meeting with the recognition of our presence in this space and on this land. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gaiakono of the Cayuga Nation. The Gaiakono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gaiakono dispossession and honor the ongoing connections of Gaiakono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. So the first order of business today is the approval of minutes from our previous meeting, which was December 14th, 2022. As per usual, this approval takes the form of unanimous consent, since the minutes are a verbatim transcript of the events and there ought not to be any corrections. If there are any corrections, please bring them to the attention of the Dean of Faculty. The second order of business is the Senate announcements and updates. We will have 2 5-minute presentations back-to-back, followed by 10 minutes for question and answers. I now invite the ILR Dean and the Scheinman's Professor of Conflict Resolution, Alex Colvin, to the floor to discuss the proposed department merger and name change in ILR. Dean Colvin, you're welcome. You have 5 minutes.
Great. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. So I'm here to present a proposed department merger and name change at ILR. Could we have the next slide, please? So it's involving two current departments, the Labor Relations, Law and History Department and the International and Comparative Labor Department. The first one, Labor Relations, Law and History, is 16 faculty members appointed to it. The second, International Comparative Labor, 6 faculty members directly appointed and 4 cross-appointed to it. So combined department will be 22 faculty members appointed to it. This is my home department as well. Both are my home departments as well. We go on to the next slide. Oh yeah, we'll stick with this one. So why are we proposing to do this merger? The core reason is there's substantial overlap in the expertise of the faculty across these two departments. These are multidisciplinary departments that study the areas of labor, employment, and work. The focus of labor relations, law, and history historically was domestic, U.S. focus, international comparative labor was international and comparative in focus, non-U.S. focus. However, if we look at disciplinary expertise, we have sociologists, political scientists, economists, lawyers, historians in these departments. And there's a number of members of the department, each of the departments who are split between the two departments, but have similar areas of academic expertise. Over time, more and more of the faculty across the department do both domestic and international research. So we have a number of faculty members who can speak to the areas of the other department. And by combining them in a merged department, we will have a sort of larger, more integrated group for making decisions around faculty hiring, tenure promotion, curricular matters. So we'll be bringing the expertise together of the faculty, faculty who already are quite integrated in many fashions. There is an ambition here. We like to think this is the will be the world's strongest department in this area, the strongest labor and employment relations department in the world. So there is a sort of intellectual ambition behind this as well. There's been a lot of faculty discussion leading up to the proposed merger. Both departments independently and together discuss this extensively. Faculty vote, 20 faculty members in favor, 2 abstained. A clearly decisive vote in favor of the merger. We also had extensive discussions around the name for a new department. It might not surprise folks to know that that was perhaps the most involved discussion. There were a lot of ideas about what the name should be and lots of different ideas. Eventually, it was settled on that the strongest support was for the name Global Labor and Work, reflecting both the global ambitions of the department and also the multidisciplinary nature. Some of our disciplines use labor more, some use work more, and this is inclusive of both etymologies. There was a unanimous department and then subsequent school votes in favor of the new name after a name had been settled on. So it must suggest that people didn't like their own proposals, but they were all willing to go along with this name in the end. Next slide, please. So impacts of the merger. I think this is important always to think about the impacts of decisions like this. We aren't anticipating any new administrative costs from the combination of the departments. In ILR, many of the services supporting departments are actually provided at the school level rather than the department level. So there's relatively less in the way of administrative costs. I have committed as dean additional faculty lines to support the new department. So I've committed to 3 additional new faculty hires to support it and hopefully realize that global ambition to be the best department in the world in this area. There aren't any implications for undergraduate curricular matters because we have a single major at ILR. We're a school with a single BS in ILR. And so its curricular matters are determined at the school level. There will be actually, I think, better coordination with the two departments together in terms of teaching. So hopefully that will be an improvement, but we're not changing any degree names. Doctoral education is obviously within the field system. The field is ILR as a field. The two departments have already collaborated extensively on doctoral education in terms of admissions and advising, course planning. So we don't anticipate changes there. They are in the process as a combined department in planning to have a new concentration in our MS program on labor research and policy. I think this is an exciting opportunity to improve our education of students interested in careers related to the labor movement and labor policy. And so that's in the works. That will be sent to the graduate school for their approval. That's under the authority of the graduate school, but that will be supported out of this department. The last thing in terms of impact that I'll mention is the issue of tenure promotion procedures. We've taken the approach that for faculty members in the department, they are entitled to choose whether to proceed through the tenure review under the departmental structure they came in on or the new department structure after the merger. So grandparenting and the faculty members. And in the annual review meetings that I have with the junior faculty, I've been discussing this with them and we've been putting this in their letters. So we don't anticipate concerns there. And I should also mention, it is a school-wide, we also have a school-wide vote in ILR on tenure cases. So everybody in the department will already be voting on the tenure cases in any event.
Okay, awesome. Thank you very much. Okay, our next item of business is I'll invite Eve DeRosa to come, the Dean of Faculty, to come to the floor to discuss announcements and updates. Dean DeRosa, you have 5 minutes.
Why, thank you. I will hold this because I'm going to do something terrible. So I just wanted to remind the senators in the room and those of you online that we will have 3 votes. We will be voting on the S.C. Johnson College of Business 10-year harmonization clock, going from 6 to 8 years for tenure. We will vote on the medical gynecologist and the health services at the university resolution, and the academic freedom in global hubs resolution. All 3 of these are being presented today. You'll receive a link tomorrow morning, and then you have 2 weeks to vote. We have extensive updates for the research, teaching, and extension faculty. So we have compiled all of the RT faculty across the university and campuses. We now know who our senators are representing, and so they will receive that. Of course, our RT at large represent their own perspectives, but the ones that are representing schools and colleges will receive their constituents, which is new. And so in doing that, we realized that there's a need for reapportionment. And so we currently do not have representation for the research division, the many research institutes on campus, and we do not have representation for the School of Continuing Education, and both of which have significant numbers of RTE. So we will be doing that. And we're also, while I'm mentioning this, we're also going to have to reapportion our Senate representation because we have new schools like the School of Public Policy that do not have representation as well. And then lastly, and this will all, of course, go through the Nominations and Elections Committee and then to the Senate. And then finally, we have a RTE resolution that has been drafted by the Senate Task Force. And they would like to shop this first to the RTE senators. And then after the senators have had an opportunity to revise it, if needed, then it'll be shared with RTE faculty across the campus so they can sponsor it. And then it will come to the Senate. And we're hoping all of this will happen by March. And next slide, please. In March, in addition to our RTE resolution, we will also have the Presidential Task Force on Undergraduate Admissions come and update the Senate on the process and progress that's happening in that front. And we will also have the swim test resolution from the Physical Education Committee. And the Senate committee has been working really hard for like the last 3 or 4 semesters on whether to eliminate or retain the swim test, compulsory swim test at Cornell. And it looks like we will be keeping it and also building in and expanding so that transfer students will also have the requirement to pass the swim test. And that will come to the Senate as well in March. And the last thing that we definitely will have, but I can't promise this will happen in March. I think it would be more likely in April, is the research scientist title that's outside of the research divisions. That's exclusively where it lives at this moment. And in fact, it was something that should have sort of become vestigial, but the College of Information Sciences, Computing and Information Sciences, as well as other places on campus like Cal's, would like to bring the research scientist back, that title back, but in a different form. And we're working on that with academic HR, the provost, and I will bring that to the Senate, of course, and we'll continue these conversations. It's not as easy. We have 8 or 9 RTE faculty with that title across the campus, but so that's something else to resolve. And those are the announcements and updates.
Fantastic, thank you. We now have 10 minutes for conversation or any questions and answers. If anyone has any questions for either Dean Colvin or for Dean DeRosa, now is your chance. If you're, please state, you can. If you're online, you can raise your hand. If you're in person, please feel free to come down to a microphone and please state your name and affiliation as you begin your question. So we have one person in person, and then we'll move to Ken Berman, who's online.
Andy Horbel, RTE, Faculty at Large, Senator. You mentioned the constituent list to be distributed to the school and college RTE faculty reps, and you mentioned that at-large senators are expected to represent their own views. Is there any interest in a constituent list that would be for at-large senators to do things like recruit for vacancies for committees or to provide a means for RTE faculty to communicate with at-large senators, or is it again that the expectation is that we're representing our own views and thus that there's no need for that, or that RTE faculties in colleges and schools could reach out to us if they had anything they wanted us to address?
So my understanding, I'm sorry that I keep taking this off, Kenny and Matt. So my understanding is at-large senators do represent their point of view, and then those that are inside the colleges and schools would do the sort of reaching out to their constituents to be to involve them in the issues. That does not preclude you from reaching out, of course, and there's also the Senate Task Force, where is another place to sort of have conversation about issues important to RTE faculty. So yes, I welcome you to reach out to as many people as you want. I love the energy you bring, Andy, so yes. And then I guess for the, like for example, the resolution that's currently drafted will come to you. Even though you're not representing a college or school, you will have the opportunity to add your voice to that.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Harry Katz, have an online question.
Thanks. Actually, I just have an endorsement statement to make, and I'll make it brief. And that is, I've been a member of the Labor Relations, Law, and History Department, the one that's being merged with the International Department and ILR. I just want to emphasize Alex has nicely presented the case, but I'd also just like to highlight for everybody that this is very much a faculty-driven switch. Alex has been supporting it as dean. The faculty have strongly endorsed and are substantially behind, not just signaled by that vote, but on many other indications. They're very much in favor of this merging. Thanks.
Thank you. Ken Berman.
Yeah, Ken Berman, Computer Science. Alex, I also want to actually ask a question regarding your proposal, but I support it, and I think it seems to be a very sound and carefully thought through activity. I'm just curious to know whether there'll be any sort of a budget impact, positive or negative, associated with this merger. The reason I ask is that in the past, there have been a number of organizational changes that have turned out to be costly in some cases. And of course, we're under a period of budget stress. So I just think that for completeness of the proposal, I'd just be interested to understand if it's gonna result in hiring new administrators, or other types of you know, costs that we're not currently seeing. Of course, savings are possible too.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So to understand kind of the budget impact at ILR, it's important to know that our departmental budgets only include a sort of small administrative and workshop kind of budget. It's sort of about $10,000 a year. So those were just, you know, doubling essentially. So, you know, keeping each of those budgets. A lot of the functions are done at the school level. We have a department admin assistants, but we don't have a department manager. That's done out of the school level. So there's no change there. We're not changing the number of administrative assistants supporting the faculty. We base that on the number of faculty members. So there's no change on that. You know, really the only budgetary impact really is that I'm authorizing additional faculty hires, you know, which is in line with our strategy as a school wanting to grow this area. So that's the one budgetary impact that I'm taking on is adding faculty here.
okay, I got it. Hi, Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. Actually, that's also my home department, ILR, but and I voted for the merger, but that's not why I'm up here. What I wanted to ask was about the RTE faculty numbers and the percentage of faculty at Cornell. I think it would be really useful for all of us to know how many faculty are on the tenure track and tenured lines and how many are on RTE faculty lines. And that may be a part of the task force report that will be shared. But I think just as a general matter, it'd be really useful to know that. And I know that that won't what I just asked about won't include faculty who have sort of temporary appointments. But I think we really need to know those percentages and also how it breaks down by college and school, et cetera.
Yes. So last spring, I did just that and presented it to the Senate. And we learned a lot. I think it was an important exercise. So we broke down across all the schools and colleges the percentage of university faculty, which is the term for tenure track faculty in the bylaws. We had the research RTE faculty, teaching RTE faculty, and extension RTE faculty separated. So we saw four classes of faculty for each college. So you can get a sense of the flavor of RTE in each of the colleges and schools. And we are about to receive the results from the work life survey. And if you remember, we were able to integrate RTE-driven questions into the university's work-life survey for the first time. These were questions generated by the task force. And so we intend, and it was given both to RTE faculty and to tenure track faculty and tenure track faculty. And our intention is to look at the results for all of the questions for the work-life survey, separating tenure track from research, from teaching, from extension, from university, librarians, curators, and archivists, because there are different needs. And so trying to learn from that. And I've recently received from IRP updated numbers for the apportionment. And with that, and I should mention this as well, we're also looking at the distribution or proportion of what sex is in the different classes of faculty, as well as race. And that is because I've received concerns that women and people of color are being pushed towards RTE contract-based faculty positions and not towards tenure track. And so we'll get the data and know if this is real or not.
Do we have any other questions or comments on either of the two announcements? I don't see anything online. Nobody's rushing down towards the front in this room. So with that, thank you very much. And if there are no further points of discussion, we will move to our resolutions. As a reminder, we have three proposed resolutions to consider today. The first is a resolution to harmonize the tenure clock across the College of Business. I invite Dyson Dean of Faculty and Research of Faculty and Research and Professor in Marketing Suzanne Hsu to the microphone. Dean Hsu will have 5 minutes to present the resolution, followed by 10 minutes for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here back in front of the Senate. I presented this proposal in December of last year. So today I'm going to do a very quick summary to set up the resolution to help you think through it for voting. So if we could have the next slide, please. As a bit of background on this, why is it that we're doing this tenure clock harmonization? Before the merger of the three schools, the Dyson School, what's now the Nolan Hotel School, and the Johnson Graduate School of Management into the College of Business several years ago, the Johnson School had successfully brought here to the Senate a resolution to move their clock to an 8-year tenure clock, and that was based on competitive pressures. Since the merger and the three schools are now together, we have a situation where two of the schools, Dyson and Nolan, came in maintaining the 6-year tenure clock that the university traditionally used, and the Johnson School had the 8-year clock. And so we had a bit of a mismatch within the college across the three schools. in a time in which tenure decisions were being made internal to the schools and based on school faculty votes, that was sort of survivable. But based on a task force that was put together in 2021, and next slide, please, we have restructured the college to move all of the faculty out of the schools and into the college itself into areas, discipline areas. You can think of them as departments in other parts of the university. And so under this new structure, the faculty sit in those areas. That is their tenure home. Those are the faculty who vote on each other's promotion, reappointment, tenure processes. And then they are affiliated with the schools to handle teaching because the schools are very program and student focused. And so the Dyson, Johnson, and Nolan schools, you can imagine those as the red bars, and the faculty sitting in the areas that are the horizontal bars up and down. The impact of this is that imagine the area of marketing where I come from, which is the middle one up there of the bluish colored bars. In marketing last year, we hired two new faculty into the Johnson Graduate School. This year, we've hired one new faculty already into the Nolan School, and we're working on hiring another faculty into the Dyson School. So that's four new untenured assistant professors coming into that area of marketing. They're drawn from the same hiring pool. They have the same sort of expectations in terms of what their publications should look like. They go to the same conferences. They publish in the same outlets. They will be voted on by the same group of faculty when it comes time for tenure. And yet, when we hire these faculty right now, the ones coming in with an affiliation to Dyson and Nolan come in with 6 years, and those coming in with an affiliation to Johnson come in with 8 years. And it's creating some, confusion on expectations within the areas, let me put it that way. And so that is one of the things we are trying to resolve. Even this week, we made an offer to one of our other areas for an assistant professor affiliated with the Dyson School. And she came back and said, why is it that my colleagues in the Johnson School will have 8 years and I'll only get six? So this is coming up as an issue for us in recruitment. And that leads to the next point, which if we can go to the next slide, please. One of the things in these hiring pools for the business school faculty, we are up against a competitive set that has been moving to longer tenure clocks, anywhere from 7 to 9 years. And our candidates that we're bringing in know this. They prefer longer clocks. They would rather have an 8-year clock than a 6-year clock. And so when our college sat down and looked at this question of harmonization, we chose the 8-year clock as a better competitive standard to have across our three schools than a 6-year clock. So final slide, please. Just to summarize where we stand with this resolution, the question of harmonizing tenure is something that came up through the 2021 task force, has been endorsed by the provost as something that we need to do. We put together a committee to work on this. We've done votes within our faculty. It's strongly supported by a majority of our faculty to switch to this 8-year clock. It allows us to be competitive to the other schools that we're up against for new faculty. And this is something that now, at this point, we have presented to the Provost Staff Council, the Academic Deans Meeting, the Senate's Academic Freedom and Professional Status of the Faculty Committee, and was presented here in December to the Faculty Senate. So I'm asking to move forward with the resolution. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Dean Chu. We now have 10 minutes for that are slated for any discussion associated with this proposal. And a reminder that the option to vote will be made open tomorrow in your ballots. You'll get an email.
Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. I know we had that long discussion in December about this, but what I wanted to highlight here is that the 6-year tenure clock is the standard. It actually comes from the AAUP standards, the American Association of University Professors, as a protection of faculty. So rather than having a longer tenure clock, which can actually create a burden for faculty in terms of coming up for a tenure review, the 6-year clock is protective of tenure, and this is the exception. So, you know, I understand the arguments with regard to the business school and harmonizing, et cetera, but I think this is an issue that we should really be cognizant of in terms of, you know, whether this is truly going to be viewed as an exception or whether it may affect other views about the tenure clock. And perhaps you could talk about that.
So I cannot speak for other parts of the university and what would happen to a tenure clock more generally. I think in our view, this is an exception, but it's also an exception that within the space of business schools has become pretty standard. And so, you know, perhaps if you use that as the competitive set, I think it's a direction that we've been sort of pushed to move to be able to compete in that arena. The other thing I will mention into the spirit of why there's a 6-year clock of not sort of taking advantage of faculty for a super long period of time, we are putting extra attention onto the midpoint review that would go with this. We've had some discussion on whether that should be at 4 years or 5 years. 5 years starts to feel much more similar to a 6-year tenure clock where the faculty member is getting, after a reasonable number of years, some very in-depth, thoughtful feedback on how they're doing on progress and given the opportunity at that point to move on, but not being forced out if they haven't quite accomplished enough for tenure. Again, this is something that our faculty, as we're hiring them, are really pushing for and demanding. So there's a little bit of feeling that the marketplace itself has moved into a direction of encouraging this longer clock.
We have a couple of online hands raised, and I realized I didn't say this at the beginning. For everyone who's making comments, to keep those comments to 2 minutes. Debbie Cherney, you have the floor.
Okay, Debbie Cherney, Animal Science. I was just wondering what that would do to faculty salaries, given that you usually get a pretty good raise, at least in the contract colleges, when you become tenured with the associate professor.
An excellent question. We're very focused on being competitive in the marketplace on our salaries for our existing faculty and watching those carefully. You can imagine a world where one of our faculty who's an assistant professor who hasn't hit that 8-year clock for coming up for tenure yet starts getting outside offers to push where they might be able to get tenure at another institution if they have a record that would allow them to do so. We intend to be, again, sort of competitive and responsive on those as well. And so if we see faculty salaries increasing elsewhere that we're not keeping pace with because they haven't hit associate yet, we make market adjustments and we come in and we make sure that our faculty are being well cared from a salary perspective. So I don't expect that to be a disadvantage for our faculty, but there will continue to be a bump at associate. It's just that the bump itself might not be quite as large as a percentage because they've been increased over time if they're doing well and they're attracting attention in the marketplace.
And Laurent.
Laurent Dubreuil for Roman Studies. It's really a question of comprehension, in fact, and I might be biased because I was only for 2 years on the tenure track before getting tenure, but I don't really understand why there would be a competitive advantage to stay on a position without tenure for a longer time. I heard that you were saying that the people you hire tend to prefer longer clocks, but if you have more explanation for me, I would be happy to hear that.
It's a good question and a tricky one to answer because I feel like all of us as research faculty who are on the tenure track feel that the effort to put out publications and papers and to keep up with that research process is a grueling one. So I don't want to claim that the College of Business is somehow different on this dimension. I think what we do tend to see among our faculty is that the pace of research publication is a bit lumpy. And so a paper can easily take 3 or 4 years to get out. And when we see our faculty publish, our, especially our young assistant professors, they might have 2 years with no papers and suddenly a year with 3 or 4 papers. And so 8 years gives us a little bit more time to sort of spread that out and see what the overall average of publication looks like, rather than hitting them perhaps at a time when they've got a lot working in the pipeline that could still make it out. And again, those are the ones that right now we're very vulnerable to lose because other universities that have longer clocks can hire them and give them an extended period of time to finish getting that pipeline out and become really productive, impactful researchers. Whereas if we'd had a longer clock and been able to give them a little more time, we'd be able to keep them here, which is often what we'd like to do.
Thank you. Harold Hodes.
Double unmuting. Okay, I think I've unmuted. Harold Hodes, philosophy. I wonder, will there be an increase in the expected publication corpus for someone who is coming up after 8 years as opposed to after 6 years? Wouldn't the thought be, well, this person has had an additional 2 years. We'd expect this person to have published a certain amount more after 8 years than after 6 years. I would expect that things would work that way. And given that, I really am still baffled about what would be so appealing to people about having 8 years rather than 6 years, if they're going to have a greater total output after 8 years.
Very nice question. And absolutely, after 8 years, we would expect an uptick in publications relative to 6 years. That's part of, honestly, what's causing us trouble right now, because within our areas, again, imagine those two faculty who've been hired in at the same time but are now under different clocks. The faculty evaluating for them for tenure cannot put the two cases side by side because the expectations are different in terms of what they should have produced during the time up till the tenure decision. So yes, after 8 years, we will expect a higher publication rate. But again, because it's a bit of a lumpy publication rate, it gives them a little bit more time to get the papers that are in their pipeline through before coming up for tenure.
Okay, I see no one running down to the front of the room in person, and I see a cessation of questions from the online audience. I just want to use a second to remind everyone to sign in, whether you're in person or online. If you're in person, there are sign sheets by each of the entrances, so make sure you do sign in. I continue to not see any more questions, so thank you very much, Dean Hsu. And again, a reminder is that you will have a ballot coming into your emails tomorrow morning and be able to vote on this resolution. Okay, with no further discussion, we'll move to our next order of business, which is the resolution to provide funds for an MD gynecologist at Cornell Health. Graduate student and PhD candidate in plant biology, Ariel Johnson, is here to present this resolution to the Faculty Senate. Ariel will have 5 minutes, followed by 10 minutes for discussion.
Thank you. Oops. There we go. So I'm Ariel Johnson, and I'm a PhD candidate in plant biology and SIPS, and I'm a co-founder and the current treasurer of the Pelvic Pain Association at Cornell, which is a student-run support and advocacy group for people with pelvic pain. A lot of people's work went into this resolution, so I would like to thank the 12 undergraduate and graduate organizations focused on diversity, equity, and/or healthcare who contributed to and endorsed it. Thank you as well to the University Faculty Committee for helping bring this resolution to the floor today. For context, we're trying to pass this through all of the shared governance bodies here at Cornell, and a nearly identical version of this resolution has already passed the Student Assembly, the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly, and the University Assembly. So simply put, we believe Cornell needs an MD gynecologist on campus for students. It's a reasonable ask because many of our peer institutions, including Harvard and Yale, do provide this level of care to their students. At Cornell Health on our Ithaca campus, gynecological care is currently performed by nurse practitioners who have expertise in that area, who many people have a great experience with. We want to add an MD gynecologist, which would expand the type of care that's available to students. Currently, students are referred off campus for common pelvic pain conditions and to get basic diagnostic care like an ultrasound. These off-campus referrals are especially an issue here at Cornell because we are relatively isolated in Ithaca, and most MD gynecologists in the community focus on pregnancy, which doesn't cover all of the needs of our student population. That means that folks have had to drive to Cortland, Rochester, or beyond to get care that we should be able to get here. Having an MD gynecologist for students would enable quick diagnoses and better care for common chronic conditions like vulvodynia, PCOS, and endometriosis, as well as other common conditions like fibroids and ovarian cysts. Part of the motivation for this resolution came from hearing over and over again from members of the Pelvic Pain Association at Cornell who have had to drive to places like New Haven, Connecticut, or even the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota to get care for common gynecological issues. Others have told me that they had to wait for school breaks to get their gynecological issues addressed, even when they felt they needed care sooner. I'm also speaking from personal experience. I have endometriosis. It's a very common condition that affects around 5 to 10% of cis women. We don't have great stats for non-binary and transmasculine people. Basically, uterine lining tissue grows outside your uterus and causes scarring on other organs. In my case, the outside of my uterus and one of my ovaries, and often intense pain as well as other symptoms. It took me about 2 years to get diagnosed. After months of coming into Cornell Health repeatedly, I was referred out to an MD gynecologist and went to almost every gynecological practice in town, including Midwifery Associates, Renaissance, Planned Parenthood, et cetera. Finally, I went to a practice in Rochester where an MD gynecologist there told me that I had classic endometriosis symptoms and gave me a clinical diagnosis so that we could start managing the condition and look into other options like surgery. I believe that having an MD gynecologist here on campus who could handle the most common conditions in our student population would have saved me years of physical pain and uncertainty. I just want to emphasize, this is a very common condition. Now, let's consider that I experienced these things as a wealthy white woman navigating this system. Imagine if I didn't have the financial means to afford a car or had dependents or campus job responsibilities that prevented me from driving to Rochester for regular appointments. One night there was a blizzard and I paid $250 to stay overnight in a hotel in Rochester so that I could make my appointment. That is over twice the maximum grad student stipend per day before taxes. Also, as a white woman from a wealthy background, most nurses and doctors took me seriously when I said I was in pain, which studies show is not true for Black women who have pelvic pain and many medical practices. I'm also cisgender, and I don't experience the obstacles that gender nonconforming people face in trying to get inclusive care. I have effectively only been able to get good healthcare and continue with my degree because of my privileged position. I shudder to think about what's probably happening to other students right now if they're forced to leave their gynecological health issues untreated. Having access to an MD gynecologist at Cornell Health is a basic equity issue for students. Thank you all for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ariel. We have 10 minutes for questions. A question online. Denise Ramsey.
Hi, yes, thank you for that presentation. I don't have a question so much as just to sort of voice my support here. I think, frankly, at a school this size, this resolution seems like a no-brainer at any time, but I would emphasize that we are in a particular time, where women's reproductive health is fraught in America, right? And so this becomes even more important. I would also just note that Ithaca is a very difficult place for anyone to get professional medical services. There's really a dearth of providers overall, and specifically, gynecological or obstetric providers. And so Cornell having this this sort of capacity in-house becomes even more important in a place that's as isolated as it is. Thanks.
Thank you.
We have a question in the chat. Jill is going to read that for us.
This question is from Evan Cooch from Natural Resources and the Environment. I'm wondering if anyone... Excuse me.
I can see if I can see it. All right, Jill unplugged from Zoom. So, oh, it was to Jill. Okay. We're going to go to a couple of other questions, and then you can bring that one back in. Harry Katz.
I'm very sympathetic to your concerns, but I guess I'm wondering why it is, given the need that you've articulated and also personally experienced, the system isn't responding. And you know, it may well be that what we have is a system failure, and we're trying to put a Band-Aid on it, in that maybe there are many other serious medical conditions that warrant attention on campus, and people face, just as you face, serious difficulties getting those conditions addressed. And so I'm wondering whether this is like the clock striking 13. It's telling us there's something wrong with the nature and extent of medical care we're providing to our students. And we need to have a systematic look at that, rather than just single out one particular area, as warranted as it may well be, that shows the deficiencies of the current system. So that's what I'm worried about, is why wasn't this addressed through our normal budget staffing process at the university? And if it's not, maybe that tells us there's something fundamentally wrong with that overall system. Thanks.
We've been in dialogue with Cornell Health for over a year. When we met with them, I want to say early 2022 or late 2021, they did tell us that basically they don't control the overall level of funding given to Cornell Health. So there's several areas, including, you know, gynecological care, but also including things like, you know, dietitians, where they do feel like they could, they would benefit from having, you know, additional staff members to cover very specific medical areas, but the budget for that is just not under their control. So that was part of the motivation to address this through, you know, shared governance, because we can't take this issue directly to Cornell Health because, you know, they're sympathetic, but they don't control their own budget. We also initially, before writing shared governance resolutions, also approached our student elected trustee to see whether this was more of a like trustee issue. And we're told again, like it's not quite to the level of something that the trustees would control, and that we would be better off bringing it to the attention of the administration, and specifically, you know, like deans and the vice presidents and people who actually more directly control the finances of Cornell Health. So in terms of like this being a systemic issue, it is very true that there's a lot of difficulty finding specialty medical services, as folks have just pointed out, in Ithaca. But the fact that, you know, approximately half the student population could benefit from having an MD gynecologist, and just how common, you know, a lot of these pelvic pain conditions, both like chronic pelvic pain conditions and acute pelvic pain conditions are, is, and other conditions that require a gynecologist, you know, I think this is something that really would have a broad impact, as opposed to, you know, hiring somebody who who could only help a very small fraction of the population. This is a very widespread need.
Thank you. We have that one from the chat. Okay, go ahead.
So this question is from Evan Cooch, Natural Resources and the Environment. I'm wondering if anyone involved with this request has reached out to Cornell Health directly to ask their perspective on this topic. Do you have data supporting need? Healthcare facilities everywhere need to make choices about their staffing and services. Typically, these decisions are data-driven. It might be helpful for us to know more about the experience at Cornell Health and at related providers in the Ithaca community before voting on this resolution. And he added, real data beyond individual experiences, as compelling as they might be.
Yeah, so I already addressed this in part, just to say, you know, we did talk to Cornell Health. Some of the questions we asked Cornell Health were whether they collected patient outcome data that they like revisited and analyzed, specifically about gynecological care and about like chronic pelvic pain conditions where students are going to be coming in, you know, multiple times, and there, you know, would be an opportunity to do that kind of analysis. And the answer is no, they don't collect that type of data, and they don't have the capacity to do that kind of analysis. They also do not collect data on how successful referrals to the community were. So basically, you know, if you get referred to a gynecologist in the community and then you have a bad experience, that information is not currently generally making its way back to Cornell Health, except in the form of a patient telling an individual care provider. So there's not any sort of, you know, record keeping or database. But again, like we think that, like just because Cornell Health doesn't currently have the staffing to analyze this data, like we think that there is sufficient evidence that this is a widespread issue. If you look at, you know, I just said, you know, 5 to 10% of, you know, cisgender women have endometriosis. If you look at the numbers for PCOS and vulvodynia, it's actually a higher proportion of the population for both of those conditions than endometriosis. So we're talking about, you know, potentially, you know, and this is a very approximate number, and different studies have different numbers, but, you know, approximately like 25% of your cis woman population of students like might have a need for gynecological care that goes beyond just like a routine checkup.
Thank you. And Xiuming Yu.
Oh, hi. Yeah, this is Xiuming from CPE. And so actually, you know, last Friday, not Friday, when I received, you know, kind of the email, right? So I shared this with our faculty. And then our head just replied, say that, you know, yeah, please, you know, tell the senator, you know, we want to increase, you know, the physicians or say doctors in the Ghana, you know, health center. So I said, is there any special, you know, for this or just general? And she just said for women health. So then, you know, yeah, I'm very glad to hear this today. And so I just saw that, yeah, there's did in has a voice, you know, from the faculty as well.
Thanks.
Thank you. We have time for one more. Betsy Blinn. Sorry, Ben.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate the work you guys did on this and the information you've provided. I also think at a university that has a medical school attached to it, that maybe something could be explored in the sense of rotations and residencies, because we do have a medical school. And that might be a way to solve that. And I don't know if you've thought about Wheel Medical or talked to them about possible rotations to get physicians here that can offer these services, because I agree with you. You're talking in general about half of the population. And as you pointed out, many of them do have these serious health concerns. Thank you.
Yeah, that is a fantastic idea. And it is one that we actually already asked Cornell Health about. And we were told that just from their current perspective, it is logistically infeasible to bring somebody to Cornell's Ithaca campus for part of the week, who's like mostly based at Cornell in New York.
I'm not sure exactly what the mechanics of like bringing a resident like specifically to Cornell Health would look like. So that's definitely a really cool idea to explore. But just in terms of like sharing residents or doctors with Weill Cornell, we were told that that was like not a possibility.
I can just say I met with the director, Gita, today.
Oh, great.
And to give you a slight update, she is actually working on such a partnership.
Oh, no
and
way.
Having rotations. It may not be with high frequency, but that is something they're trying to work through the partnership.
Okay, great. Yeah, our next meeting with Cornell Health is in 2 weeks, so I'm sure we'll get an update then.
Okay, we are unfortunately at time for this one. Sure, just a quick one.
Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. First, I want to thank you for bringing this, and I want to thank everybody who worked on it. It's, I think, a really important example of how shared governance can really bring different groups together. I just took a quick look at the list of physicians on the Cornell Health website, and there are several who specialize in sports medicine, which is important, but we have nobody who's specializing in gynecological work. I mean, I just think it's outrageous that we don't have somebody. And to echo the first commenter, this seems like a no-brainer as a yes.
Thank you for surviving the microphone and for that comment. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming forward. And thank you all for the discussion. Again, as a reminder, that will be available for voting tomorrow morning. So please check your inboxes. And thank you for your participation in faculty governance and demonstrating how faculty governance can lead to important resolutions. So our final agenda item before the good of the order is a presentation on the resolution concerning academic freedom in the global hubs. Eve DeRosa, Dean of Faculty, will provide background and context for this resolution, followed by a presentation of the resolution by Senator and Professor of Government Richard Bensel. The senator will have 10 minutes, followed by 15 minutes for Senate discussion. The first 2 minutes of the Senate discussion will go to Professor Mark Milstein, who's the director of the Center for Sustainable Global Enterprise and chair of the Faculty Senate Committee on Academic Programs and Policies. And then we'll proceed with the remainder of the Senate discussion. So we'll start with 5 minutes for Dean DeRosa.
Hi, everyone. I am now the chair of the UFC, University Faculty Committee. So when we brought this resolution to the University Faculty Committee and we were discussing how to bring this to the Senate, it was a recognition that we have many new senators who were not part of the conversation over the last few years. And so there was a request from members of the UFC to bring some context. And I guess our goal is to educate our senators before they go to their constituents, and so that everyone's having an informed conversation. There are links in the spreadsheet in the slide deck for everyone, so you can click on to certain resolutions that came through the Senate. And so hopefully this is helpful, a little bit of context. And so I want to take you 10 years ago to 2012, and President Scorton had a position paper, Bringing Cornell to the World and the World to Cornell. And this started the conversation about internationalizing Cornell. And I want to mention there was a task force convened, and I want to give the definition of internationalization, because in doing my research and trying to understand where all of this came from, I thought that was helpful, at least to me and hopefully to the senators. And so the definition is for one, it was the task force had a call to reassert global leadership in academics, research, and engagement. And the internationalization definition is a commitment confirmed through actions to infuse international and comparative perspectives into teaching, research, and engagement. And then there, sort of in response to this call to action, the Vice Provost of International Affairs at that time convened yet another task force. I think we're really good at task force, but and also action and implementation. And so this was called the Cornell Global Presence and Partnership Task Force. And what came out of that were five sort of initiatives to sponsor and foster student engagement. Oops, that's okay. To one more, go back one more. So student engagement, to foster the Analogy Center, to build more international partnerships, funding for those international partnerships, and the creation of the Internationalization Council, so the IC, which still exists. Okay, next slide. Now I'm ready. So we are now sitting here with a system called Global Hubs. And for those senators who were not part of the conversation a few years ago, and I also wasn't part of the conversation, just researching what the Global Hubs are, they are to build this, it's the student component. And so taking faculty partnerships that are pre-existing and creating relationships and partners between Cornell and partner institutions. And the idea is for Cornell students to now be sitting with student peers in this partnership university of places around the world. And I have a little link there so that you can go learn as much as you want about these different partnerships. And the idea is that it's an exchange, it's a student exchange, that those students that are in the international institution will come to Cornell for a semester or a year, and the infrastructure is there. So that, as I understand it, the Global Hubs is building that infrastructure in order for a student exchange to happen. And these are generated by faculty who are already in partnership with particular institutions around the world. I have given three resolutions, and maybe, you know, those of you who have been part of the Senate over the last 2 years when a lot of these conversations started in 2020, there might be other resolutions that you feel like we should add. Please let me know, and I will make sure that that's part of it. The three that I thought probably are most relevant are Resolution 161 regarding dual and joint degree. I put that in there, even though Global Hubs isn't going to provide any degrees, the relationship between institutions and degrees seems to be coloring the conversation. And so I think Global Hubs is distinct. It's not a degree conferring kind of program, but still, let's put it there so that new senators can know. The other resolution, specifying the rights and responsibilities of the Senate in respect to collaborative agreements and with other academic institutions and corporations. And then the last resolution, 179, consultation of the Faculty Senate. That one I was present for, and I can say that Mark Milstein, who will be the first person to speak, sits on the Internationalization Council, and he's also the chair of our Academic Policies and Procedures Committee, Senate Committee, and so that's the liaison to the Faculty Senate. Thank you.
All right, I didn't get a green light on my microphone, so it doesn't want me to speak. So next we will have a presentation by Professor Richard Bensel. We have 10 minutes.
Yeah, okay. let me begin with two very slight corrections. I am a member of the field in the Department of History, but I'm actually in the Department of Government. So that first slide was incorrect. The second one is, we got Courtney down there twice, and I'm very happy to have her, and twice is good, but that second one should be Lewis Longchamps rather than Courtney. I think that one is my fault in relaying the slide. And thank you, Eve, for a very helpful background on the resolutions. I would probably add two things to your list. The first is that, you know, since on March 31st, 2020, the Faculty Senate rejected a dual degree program between the Hotel School and Peking University, and that should probably be included there. And I'll talk about why that should be included in a moment. The second is that we did have a resolution 160, which I don't think was in your list, requiring vetting of international dual degree programs. And that one, of course, has been carried through in all of the resolutions that the Faculty Senate has passed. But I want to take my time, this time here, really to address some of the questions that have come from you, the senators, about this resolution and what its implications might be for Cornell and for faculty. One of the most important questions that have come up, and it's actually one that I've thought about a lot. Why should Cornell, including the Faculty Senate, take a stand on the policies of any foreign country? And I think a very strong argument can be made that Cornell should not take public stands on these policies. The problem is, there are two problems that are presented to us and that we try to walk between in this resolution. The first one is Cornell has taken stands. In March 2nd, 2022, President Pollack denounced Russia's deplorable and unprovoked invasion of the sovereign nation of Ukraine. She went on to say, "We do not have any academic programs currently operating in Russia." Now, the juxtaposition, there are two things about that. One is, if you take a position on one country, Russia, that does deplorable things, and you're silent on another country that does deplorable things, you created an imbalance in which the silence looks like the consent or legitimation of that second country's policies. For Cornell, this looks even worse, because Cornell does have dozens of programs in China. And because it has dozens of programs and it has many, many students in programs in Ithaca, it looks like Cornell is silent in part because of its material commitments and to China and China's commitments to us. So that what we're doing is if the central administration finds it not politic to condemn, say, what the United States government calls genocide in Xinjiang, then we, as the Faculty Senate, we can still express our horror, our misgivings, our strong condemnation of the suppression and punishment of political dissent among its citizens, both at home and abroad. And abroad, these are becoming more and more important, as you know. So this is really to redress that imbalance. Second set of questions that has come up revolve around the implications for individual faculty in conducting research or teaching in authoritarian nations. This resolution and none of the other resolutions have ever impinged or in any way limited the faculty in their teaching or research. We would never do that. We are absolutely abhorrently opposed to such things. However, the resolution does remind us, and it should remind us, the Faculty Senate should be, in part, the moral conscience, the moral authority spokesperson for the faculty and for Cornell University at large. That resolution does remind us that academic freedom and freedom of speech are fundamental values wherever Cornell creates or maintains an academic program. But it's important to say this too. It does not, this resolution does not, nor could it, but it doesn't itself close any program, whether in China or anywhere else? I should say, as an addendum to that question, some of the comments, questions coming from faculty have been, well, you know, in my home country, meaning naming a country, not the United States and not China, there are programs that inhibit academic freedom and freedom of speech, and you're not naming them in this resolution. And that's true. I don't go through those. What I would like us to see is to reorient Cornell's involvement abroad around the protection of academic freedom and freedom of speech. But we shouldn't be in the game of naming countries. China is just an extraordinary example or instance. Another question concerns the history of Faculty Senate resolutions on China and the global hub system generally. And Eve did a pretty good job of recounting that history. Those resolutions have not been obeyed by the central administration. They did not bring, for example, the global hub system before the Faculty Senate for a vote. Many of the programs abroad that are part of the global hub system, and you can look them up, they're online. Go under global hubs and you'll see it's much more extensive than just the exchange of students. As most of you know, and I just recounted that the Faculty Senate rejected the program between the Hotel School and Peking University. That was a program that, when it was described to us, was offered, the justification that was offered was that it would bring in something like $1 million a year in funds to Cornell University. After a long discussion, we rejected it. On commencement day in May of that spring, the central administration announced they would go ahead anyway with the program. In an address to the China Center last December, Vice Provost Wendy Wolford announced that there are now, and I'm quoting, 25 active agreements with Chinese institutions involving Cornell University. Only one of those has come before the Faculty Senate for a vote, and it was rejected. All the others have been created, maintained, or operating without Faculty Senate discussion and votes. This does not include, which we found out during the discussion on the hotel school, this does not include the many, many, quote, commercial agreements, that's the term that the Office of International Affairs at Cornell uses for them. This does not include commercial agreements between Cornell University and the Marriott Corporation for training programs in which Cornell awards certificates. In other words, the distinction between a certificate and a diploma or whatever. We can make that distinction, but it is also a way that of involving, compromising. The integrity of Cornell's teaching responsibilities. One of the most important of these is in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Those are the questions that have come up. We've distributed.
I just want to say that background. It puts you right at 10 minutes, so you're perfect.
Right, we're wrapping up. We've distributed the materials to almost all of you, so you know what they look like anyway. But I thought that these questions, because they'd come up during our deliberations, were important to address. Thank you very much for your time.
Excellent timing, Professor. And so we have now 15 minutes for Senate discussion, and I'd like to open the floor to Mark Milstein, from the chair of the Committee on Academic Programs and Policies. He does show up. We can give him 2 minutes at some other time. And they, at this point, we are open for comments and questions. I do see Ken Berman. Have your hand up.
Ken Berman, computer science. And let me start by just thanking Richard for a passionate and very detailed presentation. I want to express a small concern about the resolution as worded. And I generally have to say I support this type of resolution. And the concern is I feel that the wording goes in two directions at one time. That first, it talks about, in fact, maybe we could go back to the resolution. It wouldn't hurt during the QA to actually look at the thing that we're talking about. We're talking here in the whereas, the first one, about academic programs in China and other nations with authoritarian regimes, presumably Qatar and others. But then focuses on China. And then we have a series of resolutions, one of which is focused on China, but the others on other points. Now, I've been very concerned to hear about harassment of our Chinese scholars, sometimes by people on campus. We've all been reading about the country setting up apparently police stations in other countries and threatening Chinese citizens abroad. I know of cases where relatives of Cornell faculty have been, I don't want to use the word harassed, but have had encounters with police back in China. This is all very disturbing. And I'm wondering if we would be better off to have a resolution that was more pointed and focused more on the relationship with China. And perhaps this should split into two resolutions, one focused on all of the programs and one focused on China, to get the benefit of making a clear statement that disruption of our researchers and harassment of our researchers is absolutely unacceptable. Thank you.
We have Charlie Walcott, who's down here at the...
Charles Walcott. Department of Neurobiology and Behavior. I'm very much in favor of the general resolution because it seems to me that we ought to defend academic freedom throughout all of Cornell's activities. I'm worried about this mix partly for the same reason that we just heard, that this aims at China, whereas we just heard that Cornell has efforts in many other countries. And so it seems to me that the second resolution is the one that we really ought to be thinking about. And I'm worried about the last resolution here, that we should take all, the administration should take all necessary steps to ensure. I think what we need to say is, I don't see how they can do that. It's unenforceable in a way. But it seems to me that we should advocate for the administration to do all it can to preserve and to recommend academic freedom in all of its programs, not just in China.
Thank you. We have Lisa, are you coming up to the podium? You were next in line. Provided that you're coming down and getting in line. All right, you're next.
Great, thank you. Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. I'm one of the co-sponsors for the resolution, and I strongly support it. And I appreciate the comments that people have made in terms of, the questions about the focus on China and the particulars with regard to the PRC. And I think that it makes sense to have this single resolution. This does not exclude the possibilities of having other statements about other countries that where we, there are authoritarian regimes. I also wanted to point out a couple of things. One is just how important the connection is between academic freedom and faculty governance, that these two go together here and how important it is for the faculty through the shared governance process to take a stand. And I wanted to point out to you that this is more than symbolic for the faculty to do this as a collective governance matter, given our role in these sorts of programs. And what I wanted to remind you of is that in October 2018, Cornell faculty were central to the Cornell's decision to suspend the Cornell ILR Renmin University Research and Exchange Program due to violations of students' academic freedom, which included Renmin University's punishment of student activists calling for labor rights and Renmin's complicity in detaining students against their will. So this can have real impact and real teeth. And I think we should recognize that. You know, the other thing I wanted to do is to address what Charlie Walcott just raised about the word ensure. And I wanted to remind you that the Cornell policy statement on academic freedom and freedom of speech and expression, which is linked in the resolution, has the following paragraph under the heading responsibilities, which states that the Cornell community, including the University Assembly and other elected governance bodies, have a responsibility for protecting freedom of speech and academic freedom. Towards that end, the president and the president's or the president's designee shall consult with the shared governance bodies, the elected shared governance bodies, they're all listed here, and I'm not going to name them all, but that the president or the president's designee shall consult with the elected campus governance bodies on a regular basis to ensure that the community's fundamental commitments to free expression, academic freedom, and respect for others are safeguarded. So that is a term that we use in policy, and I think it belongs here as well.
Thank you. We have a couple of online questions. First, we have Courtney. Courtney Roby.
Hi, I'm Courtney Roby, the senator for Classics, the person who's listed twice as a co-sponsor. But I do very strongly support this resolution, so I'm happy to be on there twice. I also would like to respond to Charlie's point, which, you know, I take your point about the wording. I do think that substituting preserve, in order for something to be preserved, it has to exist in the first place, which I think we've seen is not guaranteed throughout the systems that we're talking about. Coupled with the excellent point that Risa just made, you know, I think ensure is good wording here. As far as Charlie's other point, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is asking a lot of the administration. In terms of, you know, working to ensure, you know, preserve, however you want to model this. But this is indeed a really important opportunity for us as an institution to think about not only the power that the central administration has to define what kind of institution we are globally, what our footprint looks like globally, but it's, you know, what is the responsibility that the administration has? What responsibilities do the faculty have? And thinking about how we can better harmonize those goals and serve the academic freedom, not just of our own faculty, but also of the faculty abroad that we're collaborating with. So thanks again to all the people who put this resolution together and shepherded it through the Senate.
Thank you. We have a comment from Rachel Beattie. Hi, Rachel.
Thank you so much. So I just wanted to take up a few of my colleagues' concerns with the way this resolution might conflate several different issues. There is the naming of China. There's an issue around academic freedom more generally and how we might support that. And then taking kind of all necessary steps in other parts of the Global Hub system. So there are a number of different potential conflated components, I think, in this resolution that caused me some concern about what it is that it's actually expressing. I'd also just want to highlight that due to the conflation of or the combination of COVID and geopolitical tensions, actually the first line that says that Cornell has been rapidly expanding academic programs in China is, I think, just factually incorrect. Over the last several years, the university has significantly reduced the number of agreements, programs, and other faculty-to-faculty collaborations due to a variety of reasons. But I also wanted to say from personal experience, just to expand on Dean DeRosa's original point around student mobility and the extensive nature of what the global hubs can provide, I wanted to just add a few personal thoughts about the kind of infrastructure that they're meant to provide across a range of different countries. Of course, they're meant to provide our students an opportunity to have a more international perspective, to know different ways of thinking, being, and existing in the world, and to be exposed to partners who are doing research that's related but not necessarily redundant to what we do here at Cornell University. So, for example, just last week I was visiting one of our partners, our strategic global hub partners at University of Ghana, and I was able to meet with several of our Cornell alumni who are now the department chair in crop sciences and leading lecturers and professors in food sciences and Institute of African Studies and climate studies. And so just such an array of long-term partnerships and strategic collaborations that's allowing not only student mobility, but also really path-breaking research around food security and climate resilience. And I think that's the nature of the global hubs as well, that take up different types of research areas and allow our faculty to partner and reduce barriers to student mobility to be able to gain from varied perspectives around the world. And I think that's really part of our goal of creating global citizens. And also I can say that as a Cornell faculty member, when I was there and meeting with our Cornell alumni who are really pushing boundaries in this research around food security, I couldn't have been more proud of our university and the work that we're doing in training scholars and the ongoing relationships and partners that allows. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. We have Connie. And again, I want to remind people I know I'm using names as I'm calling, but please state your names and your affiliation.
My name is Connie Yuan, Senator for Global Development. So Richard, I send your email, everything to faculty in global development, asked for, you know, their feedback. I didn't get any, but given my background right now, I just want to make it clear, I'm just speaking for myself as a faculty, not representing global development. I think about your resolution. I came from China, so that's a part of the background, and I'm American citizen right now. And I think for your resolution, I have the, I'm not sure singling out a country is a fair, you know, I think one thing I want to mention, you know, I think including the administration and me myself, I think what is happening in China is concerning. But is this the way to be constructive? That's a part I'm not sure. And I think I can easily name many other countries that's also authoritarian, do not respect freedom of speech too. So after this resolution, will I propose a resolution to do the similar thing to the other country? I will not, because I don't think this is constructive. And I think the university, how they handle the collaboration with Peking University, thinking, you know, speaking from someone from China, I think that's a visionary decision, but how it happened is very frustrating too. As a senator, I feel like we voted, you know, I voted at that time, you know, based on a global development's collective opinion. But if we, the senator, has spent so much time debating and the resolution is no, and then the administration still go ahead, I can understand what that process is not constructive for building trust So that's something I think a bigger question: what's the role of the Senate, and how, what's the relationship? You know, which ones decisions we can make? I think that's a bigger issue. So I understand the frustration, but on the other hand, I think you know, what's more important is constructive. I just want to mention, you know, for the what's happening in China, there are multiple ways to solve the issue, and this resolution may be one. The administration, you know, and also other faculty collaborating in China is a possible other solution. Maybe we share the same goal, but on the other hand, it just means a different. I just hope that's, you know, understood.
Thank you. We have a speaker here on the floor.
Ying Hua, Human Ecology in Cornell China Center. I, as a member of the Cornell community, I support the academic freedom as our fundamental value at Cornell. But I do want to sort of mention a concern, which also sort of express my understanding of the role or value of global hubs. So actually right now, the environment and the situation for Cornell's academic exchange with China is becoming very, very complicated, very hard, even in areas that really need collaboration between US and China. And so the way I see the service and the effort by the global hubs is actually when it's difficult, the service has a value to individual faculty's work to mitigate risks and also upholding our core value. And especially I want to mention, my concern is actually for what kind of support we provide for our students to have the willingness and then being able to do something to have first person experience to explore a different culture, develop some basis for cross-cultural understanding and communication. So the way I see it, I mean, unfortunately, I have a pretty pessimistic view of the future because of many, many crises and reasons. So we really need our next generation of professionals and leaders to have the willingness to see through the difference and then develop some. It's not, collaboration is not sort of given. We need to help them to build the capacity to work together. That's, I see how as a university, as a faculty member, so we contribute to the future of a shared future in the world. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So we are at time, and we kind of used the good of the order to proceed through this period of time. And so we are at 5 o'clock right now.
Could I respond just a bit as the presenter of the resolution?
We would need a motion to extend the meeting for 5 minutes in order to allow that response. I have a motion and I have a second. So
I shall move.
Go ahead and proceed.
So thank you all for your very good and concise comments. There's a lot of work to do. That's what all of you are saying. One resolution isn't going to solve all these problems at once. We've tried the best we can, but this, I agree, this is incomplete, and we need to do more. One of the things we need to do more is in the global hub system, in the partnerships with the different institutions in Singapore and India, Japan, and so forth, we need to know what those agreements and what how they operate. They need to come before the Faculty Senate for description so we can craft the kinds of resolutions that Ken and Charles were talking about. I must say, listening to Rachel, Vice President Wolford did embrace in her presentation to the China Center the expanding collaboration and partnership with China. She did note that the pandemic had inhibited some of that. But there is no sign at all in her comments to the China Center, which, by the way, never mentioned anything about academic freedom or freedom of speech. I will note at Cornell, these programs are expanding. So the Masters of Public Administration and the Public Policy School, almost half of all those students who pay, almost all of them paying full tuition, there's a slight scholarship program, but it's a huge moneymaker for Cordell, and it's expanding. In fact, we cannot conceive of the School of Public Policy without those students and their tuition contributions to its running. So yeah, there's a lot of work to do. We should do another resolution that captures the things that were said. This is the best we can do right now. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we will adjourn the meeting. Thank you all very much for your presentations and your participation today. And meeting is adjourned. Thank you.